need to go traveling.
Steve Earle and City of Immigrants. I'm Michael Slayton. It's a Tuesday edition of Beneath the Surface. And I want to welcome all of you to what promises to be a really tremendous show. You know, as I put this together, I was thinking 6 years since 9/11, since an event that served as the catalyst for massive changes in the world. And the show we have today is going to sort of focus up around different aspects of that. Towards the end, we have a very special segment, which is Wayne Kramer, formerly the MC5, co-founder of the White Panther Party back in the 60s, and David Was, formerly of Was Not Was, are going to be coming on and live and premiering their new song, All Been Planned. Really looking forward to that. We're also going to be talking with Matthew Rothschild, the editor of Progressive Magazine, and he has his Progressive Radio Show, a weekly syndicated radio show, and he's also the author of a new book called You Have No Rights, Stories of American Age of Repression. But leading all that off, we're going to be talking with Larry Everest. He's a reporter for Revolution Newspaper, author of Oil, Power, and Empire, Rocking the U.S. Global Agenda, and a frequent guest on our show, somebody who always brings a little bit more understanding than normal to a very complicated world and a very complicated situation. This is, when you think about what's happening here, it's really a very difficult situation today when you think about the kind of thing that's involved with all the things that are posed for us in the world today. And I wanted to say one thing, you know, something that I've been actually following very closely, and I think we need to follow a lot more. All right. One thing Larry's going to be talking about today is around Iraq and Iran, the threat of war in Iran, as well as talking about what's going on in Iraq. But I also think people need to be talking about things like Jena, Louisiana, and what's happening there. And there is a call. There is a call for people. I'm just reporting what others are saying. There is a call for people to go to Louisiana, to be there on September 20th when the sentencing of Michael Bell takes place. There are people from all walks of life. If you saw Mos Def on Bill Maher's show the other day, he's calling for people to do it. All kinds of people are calling for everybody, get on the bus. That's what they're saying. Everybody, get on the bus and get down to Jena, Louisiana. This is the Scottsboro Boys case of our times. This is a major, may just concentrate so much about what this system is about. So anyway, we're going to jump right into it now and talk and welcome Larry Everest to the show. Larry, how you doing, man?
Hey, good, Michael. How are you?
Good, good. Well, what did you think, man? You know, we were talking last Friday and, you know, you were kicking around things about Iran, and then all of a sudden, come Monday, Petraeus is testifying before Congress and he's laying out all these big plans, supposedly big plans, for his scheme in Iraq. What do you think about that? What do you think about what he was saying?
Well, you know, the main thing that struck me about it and was these people are willing to continue killing thousands and thousands of Iraqis, to destroy the country of Iraq. People don't understand what an enormous crime the United States is committing in Iraq. 4.4 million Iraqis have been driven from their homes. That's the equivalent of 48 million people in this country being driven from their homes because of violence that was triggered by the United States. Nearly a million people, according to Just Foreign Policy, have been killed. A million people. Again, that's over 20. What if over 20 million people in this country have been killed? People have access to an hour of electricity. People have no water. People don't have medical care. That is what is going on in Iraq. And these are mass murderers sitting up there discussing whether this is working or not. Working for what? Working so that they can control the situation in the Middle East? You know, I mean, I found it, if you stop and think about it, it was just staggering did anyone in the Congress, did anyone in the Senate call this out for the crime, the injustice, the mass murder that it is? And just think about this, Michael. Here's a system that is telling you they are going to continue to do this indefinitely. Petraeus said, oh, we might cut, you know, a few thousand troops now. Maybe in March we'll look at reducing a little more. Maybe in a year we'll be down to 130 or 140,000 troops from the 170,000 troops that we have there now. And of course, this totally ignores what Iraqis want, not to mention what people voted for a year ago. It's as if that was irrelevant, which in this system, your vote is irrelevant. And they just proved that yesterday and today with this testimony.
Well, you know, what about this point, though? You know, and I think it's really true, because the point of what it means, if it works, you're starting to hit at, and I think that's something that people don't really consider a whole lot, is what the hell does it mean if, you know, for imperialism, for any strategy of imperialism to work in Iraq? It can't mean anything but the most horrendous suffering for people there and people in the region, people in the rest of the world, frankly. But, you know, there's another point, you know, there is a point which I think is important to dig into a little of what this man actually said, what the, you know, he's talking about, you know, that they're going to, by next year, they're going to do what? Maybe have 30,000 out by that time. And you think about what would that mean? Even if that was the way, the direction things went, what would that mean? You know, in terms of what can happen in a year? And even that's not very clear if you listen to what Bush said today.
No, right. They're making no promises of anything. Maybe 5,000 troops out by Christmas. We'll look again at it in March of 2008. And maybe we can start scaling back to 130,000 in July. And, you know, this other point you're making, Michael, of course, the Democrats are arguing this all out in terms of, or 90% of them are, in terms of, is it working or not? You know, that's the argument of scoundrels. What you're, you know, someone is committing enormous crimes and your question is it working or not? And I think far too many people, even who are opposed to the war, are trying to argue this out on the basis of whether the surge is working or not. You know, that's irrelevant, you know, frankly. What is certainly not working in terms of the interests of the Iraqi people, and as you pointed out, look, there are, if the United States left immediately, which I am, that's what I'm for, they should pack up and leave right now. I mean, who gave the United States the right to restructure Iraqi society halfway around the globe? And there's, if the U.S. did leave, there's no guarantee. They've let loose all sorts of reactionary forces in Iraq and just created chaos and huge suffering. So my argument isn't that everything would be wonderful, but that things would be much worse if the United States is allowed to succeed in this, because number one, it legitimizes the notion that you can lie your way into a war of aggression and destroy another country, and that's okay to do. And their aim is, what is their aim there? Their aim is to turn Iraq into a forward base for U.S. imperialism in the Middle East, which they can use to pressure, to attack, to undermine other countries in the world. And all this is being driven by an agenda, which they spelled out over a decade, to make the United States the world's unchallenged and unchallengeable empire. These people feel that they have to get control of the Middle East to have this happen. They have to defeat Islamic fundamentalism of all its various trends in order to do this. And they understood Saddam Hussein didn't have weapons of mass destruction. In fact, Sidney Blumenthal on Salon just revealed that in October of 2002, I believe it was October, September 2002, Bush was told there are no weapons in Iraq, and he just dismissed it, because, of course, that was never the point anyway. The point was to use Iraq to take down the Hussein regime and to use this as a stepping stone to transform this whole region and undercut and change the conditions giving rise to all this anti-U.S. anger and fundamentalism. So why would it be any good for the U.S. to succeed in this monstrous plan that they have in the region?
Now, one question I noticed in something that when you and I were talking a little earlier, one of the points you made that I thought was really worth exploring is that this is an unjust war, as you've been sort of painting the picture of this. There's no question around that. It is absolutely an unjust war. And that even, you know, when you listen to Petraeus or you listen to any of them talk about, well, who knows how many are going to, and, you know, it is always the question of, like, who knows, which is leaving the thing open for them, which, you know, anything can happen in that region. And they may decide that whatever, they've got to even get through even more troops or pull, you know, or whatever, you know. But the thing is that even if there's, you made a point to me which really made me think, when you said even if there was only one U.S. soldier left in Iraq, they're still going to be pursuing an unjust agenda as long as they're representing the interests of U.S. imperialism in the area.
Well, that's right. And, you know, I've heard people say, well, gee, I think we have a moral obligation to Iraq to clean up the mess the United States has created. Well, yes, this country does. But that isn't the agenda being pursued by the Bush regime. And our wishes have nothing to do with the agenda they're pursuing. So a lot of times people substitute what they would like to see for what actually is. And look at what the United States is doing. One of the key benchmarks is open Iraq's oil industry up to foreign capital. Right now in Kurdistan, they've signed a tentative oil agreement with some of the big U.S. oil company. The International Monetary Fund is forcing Iraq to restructure its economy. They put in power very reactionary forces that in some ways have taken Iraq backward, even from Saddam Hussein, who I am not a supporter of in any way. But they've even pushed things backward. So this is what they've done. And now they're talking about building a base next to Iran. They're openly threatening Iran in a much more belligerent way than they have been. So you can see that whether the U.S. succeeds, whether it doesn't succeed in Iraq, if it did, it could well use its position in Iraq to attack a country like Iran, which, of course, would have catastrophic and devastating consequences for the Iranian people and, you know, the whole trajectory the world is on. So why should anyone support that kind of an agenda? And that is the agenda that the Bush regime is pursuing and is going to continue to pursue, as Petraeus and Ryan Crocker made clear Monday and Tuesday, yesterday and today, that they're going to try to fight this war as long as they need to. And what it does is it really points out the fact this system, this unjust capitalist or imperialist system we live in, depends on, lives on, must have global exploitation and domination. People should think about what all this says about this supposedly greatest of all systems in the world.
You know, let's talk about this thing around Iran, because this is something that's really been troubling me a lot. You begin to see this thing, and I remember something that someone once said when they were talking about around the first Gulf War, when they were talking about all the lies that were coming down to justify that war at the time. And somebody, Jack Gardner, who also wrote for Revolution Newspaper, said that he went to Panama and he discovered all the lies and deception that laid the basis for that. And he kept telling people that when they say Iraq, think Panama. And, you know, I was thinking this the other night. And when there's talking all this stuff about Iran right now, it's really clearly when they say that, people really need to remember and keep right in the front of their heads Iraq and all the things that were done to lay the basis for this completely unjust and criminal war. And what are some of the things you see pushing that way in Iran? Do you think it's actually a possibility that a war could develop, an attack could happen on Iran?
Well, first of all, I think it's very much of a possibility. I think people are often in denial or there's not a certainty. The United States is dealing with many different contradictions in this part of the world. So I'm not going to sit here and predict absolutely one way or another, but I will say that the war preparations by the United States have taken a leap in the last month, designating Iran's Revolutionary Guards, or they're talking about doing this. They haven't done this yet, as a terrorist organization. The first time a state organization has been so designated, which could well be an effort to claim some sort of a legal mandate for war. Bush gave an extremely bellicose speech to the American Legion on August 28th, in which he blamed Iran for murdering innocent Iraqi civilians. And of course, as I mentioned, who is the United States to talk about murdering civilians? According to the Lancet report, probably around 180,000 Iraqis have been killed directly by U.S. and coalition forces. And there's been the London Times reported that the United States was planning a 3-day blitzkrieg of hitting 1,200 targets, trying to destroy Iran as a regional power, perhaps trigger some sort of a regime change, or so they hope. And what's very sobering about this is the kind of attack described by the London Times and others, Sunday Times and others, is it come very quickly and without warning. In other words, this isn't going to be a ground invasion. It's going to be a massive air assault. So I think people should be very, very be sounding the alarm right now. And, of course, the Democrats have already signaled by voting 97-0 in the Senate for a kind of a pre-war resolution against Iran, that they're not going to oppose this. And again, what's driving this is the logic of the deepest dynamics of U.S. imperialism, the need to dominate this region of the world, the problem that Iran poses for them, not because Iran is a repressive society, which it is. I was there when they formed this whole Islamic Republic, and it's not a place I would want to live in. But that isn't the problem for the U.S. ruling class. The problem is their agenda conflicts with Iran's, and so they're driven by necessity to try to deal with them, take this regime down, step up their pressure and aggression on them. This is what kind of a system we live under again, and it's created even more necessity for itself as a result of its blunders and difficulties in Iraq. So yes, would attacking Iran be crazy? Yes, if from the standpoint of humanity, but not necessarily from the standpoint of these imperialists. And I've written a whole series on the history of U.S. intervention in Iran at for Revolution Newspaper, and I'd encourage people to look at that and understand the roots and the development. I mean, this has been building for decades, the growing possibility, the growing likelihood of a confrontation. So this is something people need to be, denouncing right now. And I think people have to confront in this. Look, I don't think Israel is driving this. This is a U.S. imperialist project. But Israel is a key ally of the United States is in the region, a key settler colonial gendarme state for the U.S. And I think people have to confront the fact of the nature of Israel and its role in all this, because that's certainly, if Iran is attacked, that's certainly going to be one justification that's put forward, the need to defend Israel.
Exactly. All right, Larry, we'll have to have you back to talk about that whole situation with Israel. And right now, what's the website that people can read your articles on?
www.revcom.us, revcom.us. And all right. Good to talk to you, Michael.
You too, Larry. Thanks a lot, and we'll have you back again soon.
Take care.
Bye now. All right, I'm Michael Slate. We're going to take a short break. It's KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll be talking with Matthew Rothschild about his new book, You Have No Rights.
Yep, it's the summertime, and it's time to think about getting that old vehicle out of your driveway. Did you know that you can support KPFK by donating an old car or truck? It's easy. You just call us at 877-573-5288 and speak to a KPFK vehicle donation representative. We'll take care of all of the details. You can also donate online at kpfk.org. Again, you can donate your car to support KPFK. Call us at 877-573-5288. And thank you for continuing to support the truly progressive voice in Southern California radio, KPFK 90.7 FM.
Dwight Tribble, the one and only Dwight Tribble, Freedom Dance. It's a beautiful, beautiful piece. I'm really happy to welcome to the show my next guest, Matthew Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive Magazine. He's based in Madison, Wisconsin. He also has a weekly syndicated radio program called Progressive Radio. And he wrote this book that's driven me crazy for the last couple of weeks, You Have No Rights, Stories of America, Stories of America in an Age of Repression. See, I got so discombobulated thinking about it and thinking about everything I've read in there that I lost the title. But it's You Have No Rights, Stories of American Age of Repression. Matt, welcome to the show.
Hey, Michael. Thanks for having me on.
Sure. So, why don't you give people an overview of what this book is and why you came to write it or how you came to write it?
Well, this is a book about how the Bush administration has stolen our rights right from under our eyes. In the first chapter, I lay out the policies, but a lot of people have written books about the repressive policies of the Bush administration. What distinguishes this book from those is that I actually tell 82 stories of individual Americans whose rights have been trampled on. Some of these people have prevailed after they sued, you know, the local police or after they sued the FBI or the Secret Service, but others have not fared so well. And so I arrange it by category, you know, people losing their jobs on in the private sector, or teachers being fired, or students being spied on, things like that. And I wanted to give people a sense, you know, an immediate sense. You know, we can talk policy till we're blue in the face, but until we understand a case like Mark Schultz, this guy was in Atlanta working at a bookstore who stopped on a Saturday morning at Caribou Coffee to get a cup of coffee before going to the bookstore, which was going to sell a new Harry Potter that day. He's standing in line reading an article about weapons of mass stupidity that his father had downloaded off the web and handed to him. Evidently, someone in line there didn't like the fact that he was reading an article about weapons of mass stupidity, which is about Fox News and how it's a propaganda organ for the Bush administration and for war, because 3 days later, the FBI come knocking at Mark Schultz's bookstore, and they said, "Were you just at Caribou Coffee 3 days ago?" And he said, "Yeah, why?" And they said, "We understand you were reading some left-wing editorial." Reading some left-wing editorial in line at a coffee shop in America gets you a visit from the FBI? I mean, come on. I write left-wing editorials. I don't like that idea. But also, even worse, as a U.S. citizen, I don't like that idea, and I don't think any of our listeners should either.
Well, you know, one of the things actually that right in the very beginning of the book that sort of really piqued my interest is when you tell the story of the people from Voices in the Wilderness going to the post office and ordering stamps for their fundraising mail out. And they asked for stamps with no flags, you know, for any stamps but flag stamps. And the postal clerk called the police on them. And I was thinking, you know, how many times do I go in and say, look, anything but flags, you know?
Yeah, I mean, this was an incredible story. This is right after I had written a story for the cover of the Progressive magazine called The New McCarthyism. And at that point, I thought I was going to leave this beat. I was going to go back to editing and talking and put my reporting pencil away. But just as that thing was at the printer, I got this call from the guy from Voices in the Wilderness, this great nonprofit, nonviolent group out of Chicago. Kathy Kelly works for them. A lot of people may know her name. Anyway, the guy who called me was Daniel Mueller, and I'd spoken with him before. I'd met him before. And he said, "Matt, you won't believe what happened to me at our post office a couple of days ago." And as you said, Michael, he had gone to ask for 4,000 first-class stamps for a fundraising mailing. They're a nonprofit. The Progressive's a nonprofit. We do these fundraising mailings all the time. We don't want to use American flags either, because a lot of the people who read the Progressive, a lot of the people who support Voices in the Wilderness, they don't like the policy of the Bush administration. And some people, you know, don't believe in patriotism either. Mm-hmm. On top of all that, they understand that patriotism can lead to nationalism, and nationalism stacks the bodies a million high over the last couple of hundred years. So this poor guy, Daniel Mueller, goes to the post office, asks for 4,000 stamps, and the teller, rather than just giving him any stamps, says, "What kind do you want?" He says, "Anything but American flag stamps." And the teller doesn't say, "Well, we got hummingbird stamps or we got butterfly stamps." In fact, the teller turns around and calls the police, and the police come and interrogate him for a couple hours, and they don't get stamps that day. They're not arrested, but they're harassed. And I have some people who are arrested. I actually have some people who are convicted in this book for doing nothing but exercising their First Amendment rights.
Yeah, you know, and one of the other areas that really concerned me a lot, especially given, you know, I'm imagining that you and I are probably somewhere close in age and, you know, experience in terms of the 60s and whatnot, and really thinking about this, you know, the importance of a campus, of a student movement, of a revolutionary student movement, of a progressive student movement to actually stand up and challenge all this stuff and to begin to really in some ways become sort of a, you know, a battering ram for the rest of society in a way of really helping to open people's eyes. And, you know, the amount of surveillance and just the depth of surveillance and the way it played that you detail around the campuses, both college and high school, you know, the kind of suppression and spying that goes on. And I was thinking about that in relation to, last week of October, Horowitz is going to have his, Students for Academic Freedom having a week against Islamofascism on 200 campuses. And you can imagine how much of that is actually also going to be rooted in this kind of spying and harassment and building up of a repressive network for the campuses. This is a really heavy thing to have that happen.
It truly is, and that touches on two points, the spying on campus, the campus surveillance, the campus infiltration that's going on, and then also what a hard time Muslim Americans and Arab Americans mm-hmm. have had after 9/11 when they all are just suspect by the virtue of how they look or what religion they practice. I have a story in here about a guy named Mohammed Farin. It's a bad time to be named Mohammed in this country, Mohammed only being the most common name in the Muslim world. This guy was trying to go to work one day as a waiter, and Bush was giving a talk at the Hyatt Harbor Hotel in Baltimore where Mohammed Farin works. He was supposed to be working the banquet that day, and he shows up for work. He goes to his locker, changes his clothes, and starts walking toward the banquet room, and his manager and two Secret Service agents come right after him. His manager asks him, "Is your name Mohammed?" Mohammed Farin almost laughed because his manager knew his name was Mohammed. He'd been working for the guy for several years. And Mohammed Farin says, "Yes, my name's Mohammed." And the Secret Service and the manager says, "You can't work here today." And they march him back to his locker, make him change his clothes, and go home. I mean, just because his name is Mohammed. And then on the campus surveillance, I mean, there are undercover police officers or army officers, in one case at the University of Texas Law School, or sheriff's deputies, in one case at Drake University in Des Moines, who are there for conferences. The one in Des Moines, Iowa, was bring our troops home, bring our National Guard home. It's kind of painful to recognize the year that was. That was the fall of 2003.
Wow.
Even then, the peace movement was calling for the troops to come home, and they aren't home yet. Mm-hmm. But there were undercover sheriff's deputies there. And actually, the prosecutor, the DA, wanted to get the names, and this will be reminiscent of this activism in the 60s and the 70s, the names of the local National Lawyers Guild that sponsored it and everybody who attended it. And they issued subpoenas to the Catholic worker peace activist who'd organized it and the National Lawyers Guild local chapter activist who'd organized that. I mean, that's incredible.
You know, one thing, Matt, is that I keep thinking, you know, I mean, a lot of the stuff that you tell, the stories that you tell in the book are, I mean, they sort of bring together the machinery of state repression, the state machinery of repression, but they also have a lot of the good German kind of thing in it where, you know, a lot of people, I remember seeing, there was this documentary, it was like a 5-part documentary on the rise of the Nazis in Germany, and they were interviewing this woman about, they were doing a section on how the Gestapo functioned in this one little area, and they said that the Gestapo was, everybody thought, because they had so many prisoners in that area and so many people rounded up and taken in and disappeared, that they thought that there was only, they thought there must have been thousands of Gestapo agents, and there were actually like 28. And the rest of them relied on the good Germans. And you have a combination, I think, which is really important, both of, you know, the kind of thing that this just monstrous machinery of repression and the kind of public opinion that gets generated, what it creates among the populace and how that actually take roots and spurs people on. I mean, a postal clerk calling up the police because you don't want flag stamps, or somebody else saying, you know, I saw somebody reading a left-wing editorial in the line at the coffee shop.
I told a story about A.J. Brown, a 19-year-old girl at Durham Tech, North Carolina, one Friday afternoon, mm-hmm. is waiting for her date to come knocking on the door and said, the FBI and the Secret Service are there. They say, we hear you have some anti-American material here. Yeah. That is reminiscent, eerily, of the McCarthy period. And all that she had on her wall was a poster of George W. Bush when he was governor of Texas, hanging people. It was an anti-death penalty poster. Of course, Bush put to death 131 people in Texas. But the fact that someone had been in her room and was ratting her out because she had a poster that opposed the death penalty, I mean, that is the good German that mm-hmm. you're talking about. Mm-hmm. And then there's, you know, the ignorant police officers who arrest someone for disturbing the peace when he's holding a sign that someone next to him who's a Bush supporter doesn't like, and so the police officer arrests the guy and claims that that is the definition of disturbing the peace.
Yeah, right.
But worse than the ignorance, and even the good German, is the authoritarian mentality among law enforcement and all the way up to the Bush administration. Yeah. I quote a guy from the California Joint Terrorism Task Force who said, when people are protesting against a war against terrorism, they're kind of like being terrorists themselves. And right there you have the equation between protest and criminality, between protest and being a terrorist.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, I think that has prevailed at the highest levels. Actually, it was Attorney General John Ashcroft who said those who scare freedom-loving peoples with the phantoms of lost liberty are giving aid and comfort
right.
to our nation's enemies,
right.
and aid
right.
and comfort to the enemy is the constitutional definition of treason, which is a capital offense.
Right, exactly. Now, I couldn't agree more with you about the you know, that actually, I think actually the focus of a lot of what, you know, the most, or the primary thing that's going on here is this state, you know, this repression at the highest levels is kind of, you know, and I know you have, you don't, you know, you're very careful not to use the word fascist, although I certainly think there's definitely elements of that, and it's certainly going in that direction.
Yeah, I don't use the F word very often.
Right. But you do talk about neo-fascism and the possibility of that developing. And one thing I wanted to talk to you about was, you know, there's this point of what I really liked and what I really appreciated was starting the book off with this whole edifice of repression, because it put this in a context, because you could read all those stories on their own and just collapse under the weight of that, you know, and really, in a certain sense, it's like, whoa, what, and how do you synthesize this? And I really appreciated the what you laid out about the edifice of repression, and in particular, because it gave me a sense, and I'd like to ask you this, about why people actually have to stand up and oppose this. That there seems to be, at least implied that there's a need for people not to wait for the next administration, but to really act now to totally repudiate what Bush and company are doing.
Yeah, I mean, we've got to tear down this edifice of repression. It's not just Bush. I mean, it was the Democrats who handed him the NSA spying law that retroactively blesses his illegal activities with the National Security Agency spying on us without a warrant. That was just a couple of months ago. It was just last fall that the Democrats, along with Republicans, handed Bush the Military Commissions Act, which allows him not only to use torture down in Guantanamo and the evidence from that torture in these trials and other secret testimony, but also to name any of us enemy combatant and throw us into jail, and if we happen to be not a U.S. citizen, to call us an alien enemy combatant and throw us into jail, never let us see a court or a lawyer again. I mean, I try to lay out what has been constructed by the Bush and Cheney administration, and to let people know that, you know, if we don't tear this down, if we don't take back and repeal the Military Commissions Act, if we don't repeal aspects of the Patriot Act that are so threatening to our rights, if we don't disallow these national security letters, if we don't stop letting the police film us when we're just protesting outside, then, you know, those powers will be in the desk drawer of the president who comes next, whether it's Hillary Clinton or John Edwards or Barack Obama or Mitt Romney or Giuliani or whoever. Those people can use those powers, or the next person after that. And people who are in the presidency don't usually relinquish powers that's been handed to them. So I think we need to recognize the hazards. And also, there are hazards right now. And there are hazards right now with the Bush administration abusing their power to the last moment of their term. And we've got to, you know, recognize that and act on it in the streets and demand of our legislators that they act on it, too.
You know, I think it's really important what you're saying about this. And in particular, this, the fact that they're setting up these precedents that are going to be there. I mean, I keep thinking of these signing statements that Bush did, and you speak to that in your book. You know, there's just this, what was it, 700 and some signing statements that he's done?
More than 750 signing statements, and that was a couple years ago. I'm sure he's issued more. In fact, he issued one last year on some obscure postal statute that allows him to open our first-class mail. That was an assigning statement. Now, what a signing statement is something that we're not taught in seventh grade or in high school civics class because it's not part of the Constitution. We're always taught how a bill becomes law. House passes it. The Senate passes it. They put it on the desk of the president, and the president has two choices. Either he signs it or he vetoes it. Well, Bush has taken another choice. He signs it, and then he essentially puts an asterisk by his name and puts below, I'm going to enforce this when I feel like it, or I'm going to enforce this when it doesn't interfere with my interpretation of my powers under the Constitution or my interpretation of my powers as commander-in-chief. Well, that's not an option for the president in our system, but it is what this president has done, and if Congress allows that to happen, if the American people allow that to happen, the next president is going to have the power. That's the irony. I mean, are Republicans going to want Hillary Clinton to have that kind of power?
Well, actually, if she's serving the interests of the imperial system, they probably couldn't care less.
Yeah, it's likely that she would.
But. Yeah, and that's the thing is I think it's really important that people do recognize that it's in the hands of the people. In the bottom line, it's in the hands of the people. People have to, you know, there has to be this upsurge to really thoroughly repudiate, and I believe to drive this regime out and to do it in a way where, you know, these kinds of things are overturned, where these precedents are done away with, and the whole edifice is taken apart, as you say. Matt,
I think when we see candidates on the campaign trail, we've got to demand of them that they take a stand on this issue.
Yeah, well, but you can do that, but let me know how it works, because I think actually people have got to be in the streets in a big way around this.
Well, so, that too, definitely.
Yeah. All right, Matt, thank you very much. I really appreciated the book. It's just a remarkable book. It's called You Have No Rights, Stories of America in an Age of Repression, and it's from the New Press. It's Matt Rothschild. He's the editor of the Progressive Magazine, and just a big book anyone who is actually out there worried and concerned or even wondering about what's going on or looking for the answer to the question posed on the back cover of the book, how free are we in the U.S. today? This book gives you a really, really brutal, frankly, and frank and honest assessment. Matt, thank you very much.
My pleasure, Mike.
Okay. I'm Michael Slate. This is KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara. And we're going to take a short break. And when we come back, we will be joined by Wayne Kramer and David Woz. Back. That's Dwight Tribble, Freedom Dance. Once again, an amazing, amazing voice, amazing album. I'm really happy to welcome today to the show, right now, Wayne Kramer, MC5, formerly MC5, and White Panther. I got to tell you, you know, that was a big thing in my life, the White Panthers. I actually really, it sort of set my sights a little bit higher than they were when I was, you know, much younger. And the MC5 actually took me places I really wasn't prepared to go, but was really glad to get there. David Woz joining me. And boy, I loved Woz Not Woz too.
Oh, thank you.
Yes. All right. So now we can just sit around and talk about what we're going to talk about today is how much you guys affected my, no, I'm sorry. I wanted to talk about, you have a new song coming out. We're going to play it in the middle of the segment here, but why don't you tell people a little bit about it first?
Go ahead, Dave.
Well, first of all, I was equally affected by Wayne growing up in Detroit and hearing the MC5 live on the campus of Wayne State University and listening to Kick Out the Jams and pounding the hell out of our dashboards while we listened to it. It was a liberating effect.
Wasn't it? Yeah.
I mean, truly. So we wrote a song about the Pat Tillman affair, the NFL player who was killed in Afghanistan by friendly fire, but that the government waited 5 weeks to inform the public and his parents that he, despite having been buried a hero, was actually cut down in some suspicious circumstances. And the reason it hit home with me is when I read the additional details that he had been quoted saying to somebody about the Iraq war that it was blanking illegal and that he was supposed to meet with Noam Chomsky on his way back home after he finished his term of service in Afghanistan, his second term over there. So, in other words, he was going to go from a poster boy for the right. Don Rumsfeld had written him personally when he enlisted, and then were to believe that when he was killed by friendly fire and everyone knew it, that it didn't reach Rumsfeld and the president immediately, like an hour after it happened, but it took him 5 weeks. So that's when I wrote a lyric, and the only guy I thought of was calling was Wayne to do the music with me.
Now, Wayne, what did you think when David came to you about that?
Well, you know, these kinds of... you know, these kinds of stories that that are coming out of this administration have to be addressed, and they have to be talked about honestly, because you know, this administration is literally getting away with murder. You know, and today, you know, September 11th, you know, 3,000 of our fellow Americans were killed in the attack in New York. But this administration has killed another 3,000 young Americans in this war in Iraq, this illegal war, this first strike war, and hundreds of thousands of Iraqis and Afghanis. And so, you know, when David says, I wrote this lyric, you know, anything David wants to do musically, I'm there. I'm part of it. And when I took a look at it and we talked about it, you know, that this kid Tillman, you know, he wasn't like he was shot in the arm in the dark, or he was shot in the ass or something. He got three rounds in the forehead from about 10 yards away. That doesn't sound like an accident to me.
Doesn't sound like friendly fire either.
You know, no. Sort of. So, I mean, we just, you know, we just said, well, you know, let's talk about this. Let's ask some questions, because I think these questions need to be asked.
Mm-hmm. And one of the inspiring moments was watching on YouTube 6 minutes of Dennis Kucinich questioning Rumsfeld, who they summoned back after his hasty departure. Not hasty enough, but...
there needed to be a few people with pitchforks behind.
Yeah.
Pitchforks would be good, yeah.
And they needed one of those Fox News body language specialists who Bill O'Reilly uses to look at this guy's eyes darting like he was on speed, looking for some friendly face in that room in Congress. And Kucinich gave him a good grilling. So I thought, you know what? This is the kind of story that in this instantaneous news age disappears and, you know, Senator from Idaho replaces it, Senator Craig, and it's a blip that's gone. So a song has a little more endurance, and we thought we'd, you know, keep it alive at least for a minute.
Now, this we're going to play this song now. This song is premiering here?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
This is
all right.
our universal premiere.
All right. Well, why don't we, you guys, is the song ready to play? Why don't we play? And this is the song All Been Planned, David Was and Wayne Kramer.
When no silver towers crumble on that fateful autumn day, he was shocked and he was humble, said it'd make the monsters pay. He hung his crimson helmet and that jersey that he wore, enlisted in an army where he said he could do more. But there'd be no more Super Sundays, no wild cheering crowds, for the poster boy has fallen and his nation should be proud. At least that's what they told us, that he died a noble death. They televised the dirty lies and cut
dance for heroes. Pat Tillman, he was one. And so were all the brave young souls who stood behind the gun. He was only 10 yards distant from that fatal trigger hand. And it's easy to imagine that it might have all been planned.
It took 5 weeks for Washington to tell his folks the truth. Pat Tillman fell from friendly fire in his dusty armor boots. They polished up a silver star and pinned it on his chest, and draped him in the flag he loved and sent him to his rest.
I know somewhere in the government, just how high we'll never know.
The voices whispered softly that the story must be sold of a young man's brave encounter with the enemy that night, how he faced his fate courageously and sacrificed his life.
Heaven is for heroes, Pat Tillman, he was one. So were all the brave young souls who stood behind the gun. He was only 10 yards distant from that fatal trigger hand. And it's easy to imagine that it might have all been planned.
All right, guys. I feel like getting more and more. Where can people get this song?
Well, you know, the way we intend to get it out in front of the public a little is with a viral video, which we're putting together now, and got some help from some people from Link TV and Democracy Now, possibly, and a company called Ambrosia Software that allows you with a program, Snaps, to grab video as it streams on the internet. So we can grab some footage without going through licensing hell.
Yeah, we're not, you know, this is not like a career move. We're not trying to make money on this. We just want to see if it can infect, you know, it can spread by infection. You know, we'll put it on the internet and just let people have it and listen to it and talk about it. And if it contributes something to the discourse on, you know, holding this administration accountable, because if these guys just run to the end of their term and walk away and retire to their ranches, it makes a mockery of democracy. Well, you know, they have to, you know, they need to be certainly impeached. I think indictments would not be out of order. You know, they are war criminals, exactly, by any definition.
Exactly. Crimes against humanity.
Crimes against humanity.
And I want to remind people that I'm Michael Slayton. This is KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara. And I'm talking with Wayne Kramer and David Was about their song, All Been Planned, about Pat Tillman and so much more. Just a really beautiful song, very powerful song. And look for it, because it's going to be everywhere soon, I hope. And, you know, one thing I wanted to ask you, too, Wayne, you were recently in Spain. I saw a picture of you. And why don't you tell people about it? Because you don't just talk, you know, there's the element of getting the music, which I think we need a lot more of, what you guys are doing, actually, really a lot more of that scene of, you know, there's got to be a million MC5s type people out there, you know, in terms of the political role that they played. But there's also something about people being active and standing up for what they're believing into. And you recently did something at a concert in Spain.
Well, you know, I've been working with World Can't Wait here in L.A. And I do what I can, you know, and being in a band sometimes affords me a platform to say something or to shine a spotlight on something or pull the sheet off somebody. And so I had a chance to make a statement at a big rock festival in Azcana, Spain, last week. And what I did is I wore the orange jumpsuit of the detainees and the black hood. and just made a piece of agitprop theater at the beginning of the set where I kneeled in the position of subservience of the prisoner and in sympathy with the detainees, and really to just express the outrage and the crime of what's happening with the detainees and what's happening with the entire this entire administration, you know, just to make a statement. And it was interesting because there was 10 to 15,000 kids there who got it immediately. I came out, I knelt down, and there, a hush went over the crowd, and then a huge cheer when they understood what I was saying, that this was wrong, and I didn't have to make a speech or anything. The image of it alone, everybody knows that image.
You know, there are so many people all over the world who have to, who are driven these days to actually drive out the Bush regime in one way or another, which is incredibly important for the future of humanity. I mean, they're talking about the possibility of war in Iran, the extension of this thing in Iraq, you know, the intensification of it. And where else are they going to go? You know, what else are they going to do? And what are they doing here? You know, the guest I had on prior to you was Matt Rothschild talking about how free are you here today? I mean, you see the edifice of repression that's been built. It's just incredibly important that everyone stand up and do what they can. David, Wayne, I want to thank you both very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Michael.
Thank you, Michael. Thanks for the opportunity.
Yeah, and we'll have to come back and just kick things around a little bit when you get a, when we get a little bit more time.
They really usually have armed guards to keep people like us away from radio stations.
Yeah, I've run into that too. Not here, but I've run into it. All right, I want to thank all of my guests today, Larry Everest, Matt Rothschild, Wayne Kramer, and David Was. And I want to thank my facilitator, director, Jennifer Kaiser, and the show was produced by me, as you'll hear more of in the not too distant future. And you can write to me if you want to at michaelslate@redfuture.com. And I'll be back again next Tuesday, same time, same place. Now, stay tuned for the community calendar and the KPFK evening news. And Zuberry Fields, thank you for your engineering help.
Wild cheering crowds for the post boy has fallen, and his nation should be proud. That's what they told us. They died a noble death. They televised the dirty lies and covered up a mess.
Heaven is for heroes. Pat Tillman, he was one. So are all the brave young souls who stood behind the gun. He was only 10 yards distant.